on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
But the inner and the outer is very true, because, you know, we do have this totally natural way of living, self and other. And because of that, we tend to see God or deities or our enlightened self in outside of us, over there, out there in another time and place, belonging somewhere else. It doesn't seem very possible to us. So what's so, I think, truly transformative and truly magical, if you like, about Tibet, is that by doing these visualizations, where you are, first of all, invoking Tara externally in quite a traditional way, but at the same time, you start to imagine yourself as Tara, second part of the actual prayer. And then there's another part where you merge the two together. So the whole idea of there being Tara out there and Anna here disappears, and there's just Tara.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, author Anna Howard joins me to discuss her book, Quest for the Enlightened Feminine. Anna shares how a mystical vision of Jesus led her on a journey to Tibetan Buddhism. She delves into the spiritual significance of Tara, the feminine deity in Tibetan Buddhism, the role of devotion, the importance of merging inner and outer realities, and the contemporary relevance of Tara's energies. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Anna Howard is an Oxford-educated student of Buddhism whose work focuses on the healing and transformative energies of Tara. A former program assistant and broadcaster for BBC Radio Oxford, Anna produced and presented a weekly program called My Life, where she conducted in-depth interviews with local people about their lives and musical interests. Anna is a workshop facilitator, teacher, healer, and author of Death Breaking the Taboo. She also worked alongside author and photographer John Davidson on the book Oxford, Images and Recollections. She has also served on the editorial team of the Good Retreat Guide for the 5th edition of the guide, visiting and reviewing retreat centers around the UK. She joins me today to discuss her book, Quest for the Enlightened Feminine, Faith, Tara, and the Path of Compassion. Anna, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Pleasure. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, absolutely. Thank you for joining me. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. Very much enjoyed your book, and I liked the approach that the first part is a sort of describing your spiritual journey and how Tara came into your life, how Tibetan Buddhism has sort of manifested in your life. And then there's a journey after that with Tara as well. So I thought that the best place to begin is to talk a little bit about your spiritual journey, because you've come a long way.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it began a long time ago. So it began well over 30 years ago. And it began, as my book begins, with what I would call a vision. It happened in a dream state, but it was totally life-changing. And it was what I call a meeting with Jesus, the Christ, out of the blue. And it woke up in me a profound calling, I would say, to return to the experience that I had when I met him, the transmission that came through his eyes. It's not like anything I've ever experienced since. And it threw me at the time, but it planted a seed. Perhaps I would say all of our potential, certainly my potential. I was shown through this experience of incredible peace, love, passion, that came through Jesus' eyes and filled me all the way through. And then the words that came were, this is who you really are. This is who everyone really is. And that was extraordinary experience.
Wow.
And it played havoc with my everyday life, as you might imagine. Turned everything upside down. I was living a very conventional life at the time, but it started something, and it began a vocation that I would say was very much within the Christian tradition initially, because that's how I thought. That was what I was familiar with. That was what I knew. And so I explored how to fulfill this wish, really, because what had happened was after the experience faded, the intensity of the experience faded, my normal self came back. And I was quite a troubled person, I would say, back then. I had a lot of emotional difficulties. I hadn't had the easiest of childhood, like lots of us. And I wasn't a secure person at all. So I think the gap between how I'd felt and who Jesus had shown me to be, really, and then my ordinary, everyday Anna Howard self, when that came back online, as it were, the gap was enormous. I thought, my goodness me, well, if I now know who I really am, what is it I have to do to be like that all the time? Not just in a dream, but to become. Because if that's my potential, that's who I really am, presumably it's possible to live that in a human existence. So I started my explorations, which were very much, as I say, in Christianity, to explore being a nun, perhaps, in a convent. But I loved that, actually. I really loved it. But I realized I was only my 20s, and it was too soon. I felt, I say too soon, I don't know whether I'll ever do it, but it felt too soon then. And so I then explored the church, but that was really not a natural fit at all in terms of being a vicar or anything like that. And in the background, I'd been doing some healing work. So when I was about, 1991, I wasn't very old, this healing gift emerged seemingly from out of the blue. I didn't know what it was at the time. It came in a spontaneous interaction with somebody. I was a bit freaked out by it at the time. I thought, no, I don't want to be doing anything witchy or anything like that. And then I began to explore what, you know, healing could be, the ministry of healing, and that it was obviously effective and helped people. So I began to offer healing work. I trained with the National Federation of Spiritual Healers and worked as an apprentice. Back in the day, they did that. And it was a good way to get the experience and become familiar with the process of giving healing to somebody. And one of my clients had been sent to me really at the very, very end of her life. In fact, she'd only been given 2 weeks to live. And she wasn't ready, and she'd been sent, and I was in my late 20s at the time and not experienced with dealing with people who were dying or anything like that. So, again, rather overwhelmed. But she trusted me, and I felt, well, I have no choice. I just have to surrender to this. I always prayed before I gave any healing, and very much to Jesus at the time. She had a strong faith in her own right. So she came in for her first session, which, again, is something I won't ever forget, because she was a very unwell lady. And yet, when I put my hands on her and began the healing, I had this really clear sense that her spirit, which was bright and shiny and perfectly well, was outside her body, joined by this kind of silvery. And it was quite striking, the contrast. And I didn't think I'd see her again. I honestly thought, she's on.
Yeah, wasn't it that she only had a couple of weeks to live? That's what the prognosis was? And when she came to you, she's like, I want one more year.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, she was very clear. Yeah. She was very clear what she wanted. And, you know, you can never make promises. You can just say, well, let's hand it over and let's see what's possible. But she got another year. That was what was extraordinary. She came back the following week, and she was right back in her body. She was vibrant. She felt 30% better. And she lived another year, almost to the day. Wow. And the first 6 months of our journey together was very much a time of feeling better, looking better, enjoying her life. And then there was a period, I remember in the winter of that year, when she just began to get a little bit more unwell. And couldn't make the clinic stairs. It became clear to me, and I think to Anne, her name was Anne, that it was going to be a question of healing into death. Mm. And that we could take that journey together in a way that gave her peace and allowed her to leave on her own terms, if you like. Mm. that would be a real, that would be healing too. And that's what happened. She did, she had a slow, gentle 6 month transition into a hospice and then literally died. I was actually in a church back home. I'd gone, going to see her and I'd gone into church and I found this prayer coming through me at the end of my time in the church. It just said, when she calls for you, Lord, please be there. And it turns out that exactly the time that she died. And she died sitting up in bed, placing a bet on the Grand National, favorite sport. I mean, it was incredible, so moving.
Yeah.
And in because that experience was such a profound one at the time, and because a lot of people around me had been clearly a bit freaked out by the fact that I was so close to death, if you like, through somebody else's experience. And I'd been expecting people to be supportive and they found it quite difficult, a lot of them. They want to talk about that. And we're not very good at talking about death in our culture. You know, we do tend to sweep it all under the carpet and things. So I thought, well, people are frightened. And yet this is so natural. This is happening. All of us are going to die. All of us are going to lose people. Actually, the process of dying is mirrored in all sorts of experiences of big change involving lots of ending in all of our lives. So why don't I try and do something to help people, write this book about death, which I did, which was a collection of interviews because I was a broadcaster at the time. And I found some wonderful people who talked to me about their experience of death. I don't really mean dying and coming back to talk about it, although there was one client who had actually died, been clinically dead twice, and come back. She was amazing. And I met the Buddhists through doing and Tibetan. And that was my first introduction to Tibetan Buddhism, which is what obviously gave rise to what we're talking about today, many years later.
Yeah. So the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Thodol, I think it's called. And what's the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche, I think. Yeah. So this kindled an interest, I guess, in Tibetan Buddhism. And when did you then begin to practice or to seriously investigate Tibetan Buddhism? How did you get from the Christian church to Tibetan monasteries?
It was a leap, and it didn't happen immediately. No, but it was a leap and certainly confused me a great deal. Quite some time. But I used to go on retreat every year for about a week in the autumn, and I usually go to a retreat or retreat center. But on this occasion, after I'd certainly read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying and encountered Buddhism, I thought, well, I really would like to go to explore more. And I had a friend at the time who was a Scotsman who knew Sami Ling, which is the Tibetan Buddhist monastery I thought first in the West, built in 1967. And I decided I'd go there. So I went up just for a week, one autumn, enjoyed it. So I was a bit shocked when I got there because at the time it was quite a muddy boot camp, I think you've got to say. It was very a building site, really. Mm. And there were lots of people there, people my age. I was in my late 20s still. And quite a few were wearing robes, but not everybody. There was a real mixture of lay people and monks and nuns. And it's very alien kind of world of Tibetan Buddhism, because it's very colourful. It's full of, you know, it's very different from what I was used to in churches, what we are used to in the West. Even though it was in Scotland, it was still seemed like another world. So I had my week there and I didn't really think very much about it. I really enjoyed it. I met people. I met one monk in particular who was friendly and I liked him very much. He was just kind of a spirited, very enthusiastic person. And so I came home to Oxfordshire, where I lived at the time after I'd had my week, and didn't think any more of it. But when I got home, it was like a set of dominoes in my life. Everything began to shut down and collapse. And I remember thinking, what's going on? No reason to be here anymore. My relationship ended. I had a house. The job that I had at the time came to an end. And I just remember sitting in my house thinking, well, I've got a mortgage to pay. I've got to get another job if I'm going to keep the house. What am I doing here? I don't want to be here. There's no reason to be here anymore. So I in the end, I prayed about it. In fact, what I did is I thought, well, I'm going to do what Buddha did. I'm going to sit under a tree. So I sat under a little apple tree in my garden, and I waited. And 6 hours later, I had a single instruction with no padding. Sell your house. That was it. But I thought, well, that was such a clear instruction. I've got to test it. So then I asked for a further sign. And I'd woken up not so long, 2 or 3 days later. I woke up one morning, much earlier than normal. I put the radio on. Didn't normally do that. It was prayer for the day, which was a BBC Radio 4 program. And it was talking about how the Israelites went into the wilderness, nothing but absurdity. And on the strength of that, I thought, well, I can do that too. I can go out into the wilderness with a roof of leaves or a canvas tent in my case if I have to. So I put the house in the market. My family went mad, but I said, I've got to do this. I've just got to trust what's going on here. I didn't even know at the time that I was going to go and live at that, but I put the house in the market. The sale went through miraculously. And during that process, I then realized that what I was going to do with the full proceeds from the sale of the house was to go up to Thamile. I applied to be a resident there, but in fact, I left before my application had been reviewed. So I just packed my thing, got in the car, drove up to Scotland, turned up at the monastery, and booked myself in. And was a bit surprised the abbot at the monastery didn't look too pleased to see me. More of which anon. But I was feeling pretty vulnerable because I had given everything up for this and I didn't know why. I was following Jesus, if you like, and here I was in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Scotland. It was very confusing. But over time, and again, initially I just felt very awkward, very different, I was very much a Westerner, very much a Southerner. And I somehow didn't quite fit in initially. But actually, I moved into the monastery and I started to work in the tea rooms, which was a most natural interface between the general public and the monastery. It was kind of a place for me where I felt comfortable. I started to work there with my monk friend. And I loved it. I really loved it. I had a bumpy time there.
Yeah. Were there a lot of other, I want to say Westerners, since this is a Tibetan Buddhist monastery, were there other people not of Tibetan descent that were staying there as well?
Definitely. In fact, most of us were Westerners. There were some Tibetans. Obviously, the two people who founded it, Trungpa Rinpoche went to the state. He wasn't there when I was there. Akon Rinpoche was there, but I didn't meet him initially. He didn't arrive back in Tibet until sometime later. But the abbot was his brother. And there were other Tibetans that had come over in exile were there. And most of the people, including the monastics, were Western. Because the abbot at the time, Lama Yeshe, he's still the abbot, but he's sort of stepped back now. He had decided that offering people the opportunity to take robes, which was very new, wasn't a familiar practice even in Tibet, to just take robes for a year or whatever. He decided that because he'd been helped so much himself by taking robes, because he'd been a bit of a rebel, well, a lot of a rebel, I think, in his early years, and then he suddenly got very serious about practice and he'd gone into retreat, Woodstock in New York State, and then come out and thought, right, this is the solution for everybody. So wherever possible, he would encourage people to be monk. So a lot of people took robes, and were living there as monastics for a year or 3 years or sometimes for life. But the life ordination process generally took a little while longer and took some testing before people were allowed to take that step.
Okay. So were you then committed to a specific amount of time that you were going to be staying there when you first showed up? Or was it just as initially as a guest or like, I don't know exactly how long I'm going to be here?
It was totally open.
Okay.
I was in the guest house, so I was there as a guest. and it was completely open. I did, you know, I'd left my life behind.
Right.
I had, so I was open to what would happen.
Okay. So when did you begin working with Tara? That's one question, but I think even preceding that, perhaps, is who is Tara?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and the answer to that question isn't that easy, because to understand Tara requires looking into different levels of our consciousness. So perhaps I can explain a little bit more about who she is.
Right.
And then answer you the question about how I connect with that.
Yeah, yeah.
So in Tibetan Buddhism, one of the ways in which it works, like, is to give us forms to relate to. They're known as deities or gods, which are enlightened, which create a bridge between our true enlightened potential, which is this, which is beyond concept, beyond language, beyond description. That's the essence, you might say. And certainly I would say that that was what I was shown back in my vision. I had that vision that Jesus, that essence. But because it's very hard for most of us in our everyday consciousness to be able to realize that, or even experience it or come close to it, we need a sort of a bridge to get there. So I see the deities as like a bridge. They're like a kind of an intermediary between this formless realm of absolute purity, love, compassion, and the human level, where we operate in our everyday 3D consciousness. So you might call them like an angel, that sort of level. So Tara, if you like, you can imagine or see or depict Tara on three of those levels. So Tara is ultimately the formless realm, cosmic awareness, which is Aura. There's no Tara at the end of the day. There's no nothing. No, she is that too. She's that source energy. But as out of which all forms come, so the idea that she's the great mother is Tara. And then as she begins to manifest in our world, she takes, it's called the Sambhogakaya level. And that's, again, at the angel level, the kind of the pure form level, which is how you would see her. So behind me, you can see an image there, image of Tara, that's a statue of Tara. So that would be her at the Sambhogakaya level. It isn't solid the way she is depicted. It's more like a rainbow. She's more like light. Just pure light. And the qualities of Tara, and in this case, it's green Tara we're talking about, although there's also white Tara, and I talk about both. But whichever one you're talking about, the essence of Tara is the same, but sometimes there are different qualities that she might, depending on which color she is or which mudra she might be showing or whatever. And when you relate to the goddess deity in an external called Tara, what you're also doing is activating your internal potential as Tara. And that's a potential that's in women, obviously, but also in men, in all sentient beings, because we're all a mix of masculine and feminine. And so although Tara is very much a figure that women would relate to and feel supported and empowered by, she's very, very important. Monastic. Tara prayers take place in most Tibetan Buddhist monasteries first thing in the morning. And, you know, as we know, most the monasteries are inhabited by monks and the nunneries by nuns. So she's important for everybody. And then at the human level, it is said that Tara manifests as an actual woman or possibly another being. Doesn't have to be female. But one of the particular things about Tara was that in the sort of human world many, many years ago, and it's a little bit of difficult to know whether this is a real story or a myth, this part, because the dates aren't clear and sometimes, you know, how myths and stories can get together or merge. So there was a woman who was an incredible practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism in the day, And she was so respected and revered that all the monks said, you know, we're going to praise you to be reborn in your next life as a monk, so that you can practice Buddhism properly. And she says, actually, no. There's no difference between a woman's body and a man's body, or in our culture. Potential is the same. So from now on, I'm going to make the promise that I will always be reborn in a female body. So that's the promise she made, Tara made. So I think that probably explains a little bit about who she is. Does that give you an answer? Does that explain that for you?
Yeah, I think so. I wanted to ask, because for listeners, you know, I've got a little bit of background in Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism is it's quite different in some aspects of other forms of Buddhism. And in particular, I was wanting to kind of clarify this idea of deity in Tibetan Buddhism, because it seems to me to be understood differently than how most people in the West would consider a deity in terms of like a god. And it seems to me that it's more, like you had said, it's kind of like an energy from a higher level of consciousness. And I hope I have that right. And please feel free to correct me.
I agree with you.
Okay.
A higher frequency.
Okay.
Because if you think of four, so we're living in this illusory world.
Right.
But it seems very real. But quantum physics shows that actually space and particles moving in space, that's reality.
Right.
That everything is at a constant state of flux. And everything has its own vibration. And because of a particular frequency within which we live, because of our brains and our perceptual system and this reality, every seeming reality, it's very difficult for us to perceive things at a higher frequency that just goes out of range until you begin to purify your own perceptual reality and your own consciousness. And then you begin to sometimes get these experiences where people talk about literally seeing the deity. They have a very real experience, because their own consciousness is so purified and has been raised to such a degree that they're actually able to have that perception. But for most of us, most of the time, especially in our everyday consciousness, that high frequency being, an angel or a deity, is out of range of our consciousness, of our perceptual consciousness. But we can, through devotion is seen as very important, with your heart, you feel it in your heart. The more important than the mind, because the mind is full of all sorts, as we know, chattering mind, but the heart is like a different kind of reality. And when we drop into our heart, and especially with devotion, our heart opens. And then we are more in touch with the qualities of the deity, I would say, that. And as I said earlier, the deity's qualities are, and there are hundreds, thousands of things, but the essence of them all, if you like, vein, which is the pure compassion, pure wisdom. Those are seen as two wings that help you fly.
Right. Life.
But they each have a different manifestation, because if you imagine pure light coming into a prism and then being reflected through these different facets of the diamond, the prism, that's how the deities work. So that if you are down on the lower level than the human level, needing, for example, more compassion, or needing fearless, or needing healing, you would invoke and do the practice for a particular deity that is strongly manifesting and transmitting those qualities. And again, we're talking in a dualistic way here, where you've got self and other, self
right.
deity out there. And the point of all deity practice is to begin to close that gap, merge the inner and outer, because it is all one, so that you begin to feel your own potential as a deity, as the enlightened being that we are. You begin to activate it within. It's a very, very clever, you know, they talk about skillful means in Tibetan Buddhism, and it has a lot of skillful means. Working with the mind, but also helping penetrate the everyday mind and into the true mind, the awareness mind.
Upaya, right? That's, I
Sorry?
think that upaya, isn't that the term for the skillful means?
Yeah.
It's very fascinating, and I sometimes I regret not having gone down the road to where Trungpa Rinpoche ended up, which is in Boulder, and founding Naropa. And I had someone ask me once, I did, study with some Buddhist scholars, and they're like, how did Naropa not take you? I'm like, well, it was me not going there. So the other question I wanted to ask, kind of still with all of what we're talking about right now, is I know that in Mahayana Buddhism, and I think this is also in Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana, there's the idea of a bodhisattva. Is Tara also a bodhisattva?
Yes, she would be called a bodhisattva as well.
Okay.
And that, as you say, that idea is that when you are a bodhisattva, you are simply here in service to.
Right.
You no longer have your own karma to live out, purify. You have transcended your karma. You are effectively necessarily fully enlightened, but you're completely devoted and dedicated to serving other beings. Yeah,
Okay.
apart.
I always find the Bodhisattva vow one of the most powerful vows that anyone can take. I don't think there's much in other traditions that really kind of equal that to say that, I am working to alleviate the suffering of all beings, and I will continue to do this through lifetimes. That's a commitment.
Big commitment, and it's and even to the point where you put off your own enlightenment, which might take you away from suffering, being you put it off in order to stay present, to stay with you. You still feel, but you're not experiencing it personally the way that we still
Okay.
the unit.
Oh, I'm not very far on the path at all. I'm very clear about that. But I've stepped on the path, I think. One of the, I guess the next question though is when we think of Tara, I think there's this tendency to think, and this is probably a Western idea of thinking of, Tara as this one discrete, almost like entity, but I don't know that it's appropriate to refer to Tara as an entity. I don't know if it's inappropriate to refer to Tara as an entity, but there are different emanations of Tara. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk about these different emanations of Tara, because that's important for what you are eventually going to do.
Yes. So there are 21 emanations of Tara in terms of the traditional understanding. You could say there are 108 emanations of Tara. There are actually no specific limitation on how Tara gets said. But it's the similar principle that Tara has her essential quality, her essential essence. But because we beings are complex and we end up in different situations where we need different kinds of help, Tara, through her 21, let's take the 21, which are the ones I write. She manifests in these different to help a specific problem. So, for example, if we begin with the 21 that I write about, this Tara, the first one is Tara enhancing harmony. And she's a white Tara, and she's peaceful. White is, the colors of the different deities also have a meaning. White is always peaceful. And she is about bringing peace, harmony, tranquility, and serenity. So if you were feeling as if you needed those qualities activated, you might focus on it. There's another Tara, for example, a yellow Tara, which is always increasing activity, increasing eloquence, increasing wisdom. There's another Tara, if you want to activate that within yourself. There's a Tara who has a powerful Tara. She's red in color. And the red color is to do with magnetizing, attracting circumstances from the outside to bring about a greater influence or a greater result. Whenever we're praying to Tara although Green Tara is very much a deity or a practice, and sadhana practices are what we do to actually invoke as a traditional method.
You've mentioned the white Tara and the green Tara. Mm-hmm. And now there are these other kind of colored Taras in there as well. So maybe we can take a step back just for a moment and talk about the distinction, if there really is a distinction, between the green Tara and the white Tara.
Absolutely. Okay. So the two Taras that most people will have heard of and many people will practice are green Tara and white Tara. And although the essence is the same, as I've said, there are definite differences. The green Tara would be considered to be dynamic compassion. She's a very active person, Tara, deity. So when you see her, the image of Tara, she always has her right leg sticking out, which symbolizes her readiness to spring into action. And she's a deity that you would call on, or a practice that you would do to generate fearlessness as well. She's a protector. She comes to save you from danger. And very often the dangers that we're talking about, they may be external, but they're very often in the mind itself. And that's very important. Doing the deity, you're calming the mind down as much or as more, you're calming down, trying to calm down in external. And then white Tara is a very different Tara. She's generally practiced in retreats. She's seen sitting in full lotus position. And she's a little bit more disconnected, if you like, from the everyday samsaric world that we tend to inhabit. And her qualities are healing, long life, and wisdom. And she's best known for her seven eyes. She has, normal eyes, and she has one on her forehead. She has two on the palms of her hand and two on the soles, which represent her capacity to see beyond, the veil of illusion, to see the way things really are, to see reality the way it really is, which is synonymous with wisdom. And then the healing and long life quality that she has. And the extension of life. So if you have perhaps a suggestion that there might be an untimely death, the Tibetan Buddhists do have a strong confidence in astrology. So sometimes astrology will say, you might have an untimely death to you. Be careful this year. Some dangers to your life. You might then go into retreat and practice white, because she can stabilize your life. Help prevent death. But all of the, in the Green Tara, again, my book, I talk a lot about this when I go on peace pilgrimage. There are 21 manifestations of Tara, and they are each very slightly different colors, different hand gestures, which are known as mudras, and they will be working different dangers, like that we might face it up. And you don't need to work the individual Tara. You can work with the central green Tara, whatever's good, if you're wanting protection. But if you do have a particular issue and you find a Tara that works specifically with that issue, that can be a very strong, direct, and confidence-building way to work with Tara, to work with her practice specifically. It's essentially the same practice, but the mantra can be different. In the book, I haven't given all the different, because it's so complicated. Working with a central, it's fun.
Yeah. Tibetan Buddhism is very complicated, I think.
It's complicated.
But it's very fascinating. Well, and one of the things that I noted in the book was, and this is really just me trying to make sure that I understand everything correctly, but you mentioned how inseparable the inner and outer realities really are. And the way my understanding is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that working with Tara is working with consciousness and trying to tap into that similar consciousness, because as we develop that within ourselves, that's going to manifest outwardly.
Absolutely. Yes, it is. So that potential, Tara within, she's in all of us.
Right.
And you asked me a little while back, you know, how did I connect with Tara in the first place?
Yeah.
And she was always there. She was always in the monastery doing Tara prayers in the morning or whatever. And I never really paid much attention. I didn't really feel the connection until I began to have some questions about the patriarchy and the hierarchy and the role of the feminine in religion or whatever. And I began to become proper in my own life, I suppose, in terms of feeling as if some of the things that were happening to me were because I was a woman and it didn't seem entirely just. So I began to think, well, you know, what about the feminine in religion? What about the feminine in Tibetan Buddhism? Where is she? And of course, she was right in front of my nose all the time in the form of Tara. And then I clicked, I made the connection. And I started to do the practice. I became very interested in actually learning about her and felt the personal resonance with her and my potential to activate my own enlightened feminine. Because I would say that my feminine was fairly wounded at the time in many ways. So to have this sense that there was an enlightened feminine was very healing and empowering and encouraging. So that was how I first made the connection with Tara. But the inner and the outer is very true because, you know, we do have this totally natural way of living, self and other. And because of that, we tend to see God or deities or our enlightened self in outside of us, over there, out there in another time and place, belonging somewhere else. It doesn't seem very possible to us. So what's so, I think, truly transformative and truly magical, if you like, about Tibet is that by doing these visualizations where you are, first of all, invoking Tara externally, in quite a traditional way, but at the same time you start to imagine yourself as Tara, second part of the actual prayer. And then there's another part where you merge the two together. So the whole idea of there being Tara out there and Tara here disappears, and there's just Tara. So the ordinary self of Anna, in my case, the ego part of me, falls away. Falls away, and I'm then in touch with my innate Tara. And meanwhile, the Tara that I've invoked and felt in my heart, called out through the prayers, that it's all my consciousness. It's all consciousness.
Right.
Seemingly internal and external, but it's actually one consciousness. And you begin to lose more and more that sense of until you're just, you are Tara, effectively. For that brief moment, you are, that is who.
No, yeah.
And the more you do that practice, the more you remember, even when you're off the cushion, because obviously it's quite, again, you come to the cushion to do the practice in a formal way, get off the cushion, and you can do anything that may have nothing to do with Tara. But gradually you try to, again, sort of close that gap between the cushion and the post-meditation session where you go about your life and you are with the Bodhisattva vow in particular, if you've taken it, which I have, I've taken it, then you try to bring those qualities of Tara to life in your mind and act in your life. When that energy of Tara is in your consciousness, it's much, the quality of actions are different. And one of the things that I think is really important and particularly strong in Buddhism is the importance of having a teacher, having a lineage behind that teacher, so you're having authentic practices that you're doing and having in power. So for some practices, not in this case, Tara, you can take a Tara practice or begin to do an introduction to Tara without having had a formal impact. But if people are serious, as obviously I, it really helps and actually is very important to find a genuine lineage teacher or teachers and hopefully be able to do an actual empowerment therapy so that you are plugged into the practice in a very pure, in a very direct way. It's difficult to describe how it acts as a protection, but it does. It means that you're not going to be coming up with too many of your own ideas about who Tara is and following those, because the spiritual ego can get enormous. So we're trying to, you know, circumvent that and bypass cut when it arrives. And the being in the same context of a traditional setting is, I think, really, really important.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think it is. And there is this, I think, individualistic streak, especially in the United States, where we're like, we don't need that. But the institutions serve a purpose, right? The history, the tradition serves a purpose. So I wanted to ask you about this, the Tara pilgrimage that you engage on eventually. And I was wondering if you could maybe explain what that was, how that came about, and why?
Well, my teacher, my root teacher, that's the one that you, the root guru is the one that you closest heart connections with, Akon Rinpoche, founded something with Triple Rinpoche at the time. And he had given me a project to raise some money for a big Tara center in Africa, to raise 20 million.
Oh.
And he always liked to give you really, really impossible talk. And at the time that you're listening to him saying, can you do this? You think, yeah, I can do that. No problem. So I came out of the interview and I thought, I've got no fundraising experience. I have no idea where to start with this. So then I sort of let the idea go. But then the idea emerged. It was one of those eureka moments. I may not be able to raise lots of money, but I can try and raise awareness. And I will do by going on a trip when I'll take little Tara's, 21 specifically, to anywhere in the world where she can benefit. So each Tara having a particular activity, I would try and match the place to the activity where she could be a benefit. So I made all these cards, which I used for my practice to work with each of the Taras. And I had my little Tara statues, which were tiny, just that big, blessed by Akon Rinpoche. And I started. My father had died as well quite recently, but just before I started this pilgrimage, and I was struggling with my grief. And also I felt that I wanted to come down south. I was living in Scotland, but I wanted to come back down south to England before he died, but sadly he died before I got home. And then I didn't really know how to come back home because I'd given up so much to a totally new life, and I felt I need to come home to try to reintegrate back into Western life again. And so the Tara Peace Pilgrimage gave me a real focus. It gave me a focus to leave, to take Tara into the world, to bring myself back into the world and to work with the grief that I had around my father. But what I didn't anticipate was, of course, the idea of traveling around the world was going to be extremely expensive and very time consuming and not at all practical. But I started with good faith, and I left Edinburgh where I was living, and I went first of all to Holy Island, to Lindon, which was a place that had been very significant early the Christian retreat there. And then I went and placed a Tara up in the north of Scotland. I mean, there were some extraordinary synchronicities there. No Tara that I'd do the practice with the individual Tara. I'd wait until I got inspiration or synchronicity as to where I was supposed to be taken. And then I'd go. And the number of, like, particular one, for example, I was guided, that's the only word I could use, to go up to the Isle of Skye, to this place right in the northeast tip of the Isle of Skye called Flodigarry. And I went with a friend. And this particular tower was the second tower meant to protect from earthquake. So we went up there, and I remember getting this rather nice youth hostel in Staffin of the peninsula and finding lying around the dissertation of a geology student. So I read it, and as I was reading it, believe it, because there was all the graphic description of why this particular part of the British Isle was the most susceptible to earthquakes of the whole country. I mean, it was extraordinary. I get goosebumps every time these things happen. I think, oh my goodness me, she's real. No, but I didn't have enough faith by then. I certainly had faith by the end of the pilgrimage. These things would happen quite a lot. But after I'd placed maybe three or four towers, I came down south to London and hit my wall. It was a really difficult period. Whereas because I thought, first of all, I was back in London, the family and my dad had gone, very difficult. But also, I thought, well, I can't do this pilgrimage. I just can't, I haven't got funds. It's not fair to raise money to go traveling. It's, how am I going to do this? And then I prayed, as I always did when in trouble, pray to Tara. And then I had this inspiration, another message. It was like, well, I am not just Tara. It's not just me.
Right.
Tara is bigger than me. That's just my ego is trying to be like Tara. She, the true Tara, the essence of me, is in all of us. So I don't have to do this on my own. Why don't I work with each of the Taras as planned, but wait until somebody appears in my life who is going where it would be relevant to take that Tara. So all of a sudden, this sort of solo pilgrimage became a team effort, a Tara team group. And it was wonderful. So I worked, one of my little Taras went to Tibet because somebody was going to Tibet. And again, this is a magical story because my friend Sarah took her to Tibet and ended up placing her, without knowing, under the main Tara statue in a Tibetan monastery, Dolma Larkin. Was big Tara statue. That monastery is the one that is associated with Akun Rinpoche, who was the founder of Sangyelin, who was behind all of these little Taras. I mean, it was extraordinary. That was extraordinary as well. So one of them went to Tibet. There's one that's gone to Alaska, one to Moscow, one to Jamaica, one to India, all over the place. And each person had I asked if they would write a little story as to how they took the Tara, what happened when they did, why they felt connected to her, how she helped them, if that wasn't happening. So I had these wonderful little reports in from people, from how they'd traveled with her, where they placed her. So she's ended up with a tiny statue in all different places all over the world.
Yeah, those stories were a lot of fun to read. I really enjoyed all of those. When there were stories, some of them, there wasn't a lot of information available. Now, you initially engaged on this to raise money for monastery. Is that right? Okay, retreat center. And I'm curious, though, if you think that there is something else at play, if there's another reason why, in a sense, that you're charged with taking Tara to all these different places. Is there another reason in addition to the raising of the money? Because it seems to me that the state of the world could really use this energy right now.
I know. I feel the same, Nick. I really do. And when I did the Tara pilgrimage, it was back in 2005, 2006. And in the nearly 20 years since then, the world has become an even more fragile and vulnerable place. And the climate crises that we face, the challenges, Tara and her energy could be of real benefit. I agree. And I suppose what I hope, and perhaps this is why I did now, I didn't know why I was doing it now. I started writing it 3 or 4 years ago, and it's coming out now. I wanted to write it because I thought, gosh, connecting with this divine feminine energy within myself, that I know is within all of us, was so life-changing, so healing, so transformative, so empowering, and so clarifying about the values that really matter, and that no matter what. And I had some massive challenges, which are in my book, that really tested my faith and really tested my capacity to stay connected to compassion and love for all people. And I think in this day and age, wherever we look, there is so much conflict. And that conflict, I think a lot of people feel very powerless. And there's a lot of division among people about opinions about what they believe or what they think or feel. And it's very hard when you're caught in that to remember that we are one, that we are one family effect. We have this one true self with a capital, and that we're manifestations of that one true self. And essentially no one being is better than we are all equal. That's one of the tenets of Buddhism, that we are all equal in our essence. And that what drives us to, what creates the suffering in the world, comes from our own attachment to ourselves as the, at the ego level, and our own identification with ourselves at that level. And at the ego level, the ego is about survival, about I need this and I don't want it. And when we think that's we are, then we're going to run after everything we want and hold on for dear life, and we're going to push away and reject what we think is a danger to that ego self. That's the suffering. It's the suffering in our own mind, suffering between, and it's the suffering, I think, in our world, in our samsaric world. So there is another way, but there is another way. It's not just this way. I want to emphasize that too. You know, I found through Tibetan Buddhism, I found a lot of what I find it still a mystical Christianity, not changed, but it's in all faith traditions and in many, in our heart, actually. We don't even need a faith tradition. It's deep down in our heart, but getting deep down into our heart and into that pure awareness of consciousness is not easy. And it usually takes discipline and practice, like meditation, that calms the everyday thinking mind down so that that true potential, which is innately peaceful, innately loving, innately joyful, no matter what step of that, can emerge and come to the fore. Yeah. It's possible. I believe it's possible. But it has to come from within. You can't impose it on anybody. It has to be in a spark that lights up.
Yeah.
And guides us.
Yeah. No, thank you for all of that. And in my mind, it goes back to that idea of the inseparableness of the inner and outer realities. And when I see the misery in the world and the suffering, I always think, but that's because it's in us. And that's where we need to start the healing. Is in each and every one of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why compassion is absolutely essential, the bedrock of Tibet.
Yeah.
Because there is compassion.
Yeah, yeah.
And wisdom is what helps us go beyond it.
Yep, we're in short supply of that these days too, it seems. but recognize that people act the way they do because of their suffering. And I think that's always important to develop that compassion. And unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time. I wish we could speak a little bit longer, but maybe some other time. But let me ask you the final questions I always ask. You've got the book coming out, and what are you working on next?
Well, I've been asking myself that question. Is there another book? I mean, this one, 30 years of living to create this book. So I hope I don't have to live another 30 years to do the next one. I feel there might be another one. I can feel it. Whether I say anything about that right now, I don't know, because I don't want to, you know, promise anything that may not come to pass or anything like that. But I think there is one, and it would be around not the divine masculine on its own, but the kind of holy union between divine masculine and feminine, the potential for enlightened relationship. That's a possibility. But other than that, then I'm not sure. And I still give my talks and workshops and healing sessions, and I'll still do that. And Tara will have her way with me. She'll be taking me wherever I need to be going.
Right.
And I am open.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. Now, is there a website that where people can go to find out more about you and lectures, healing sessions, so on and so forth?
Yes, it's www.white-tara.co.uk.
Okay, www.white-tara.co.uk. Perfect. All right. Yeah. I will put a link for that in the show notes in the video description, as well as links for your book, Quest for the Enlightened Feminine. It was quite an enjoyable read. I really enjoyed it. And I am so grateful for the time that I was able to spend chatting with you this morning. It was very lovely.
Likewise. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed for your in.
And that's a wrap on episode 170 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. And I think you all know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon. Share this with friends and family and on social media too, please. And subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But the thing is, all of that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following are all free, and they only take a few seconds of your time, and they really do help. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making some changes to the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now, doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics, and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.